Nothing on this podcast is intended as legal advice, nor does it create an attorney-client relationship. Please be advised that this podcast also contains spoilers and swears.
Hello, and welcome to Murder, She Wrote, a podcast about eccentric inventors, geriatric romance, and the world's most aggressive station wagon. I'm one of your hosts, Elizabeth.
And I'm your other host, Laura.
So, Laura, how have you been over this past intervening period of time? Because, as I will acknowledge in mea culpa once again, we have fallen off the regular schedule. But I hear there's been some exciting developments on the hobby front in your casa.
Yes, our household has taken up bird watching. We're getting very into it. So far, we've seen a bunch of house finches and golden finches, eastern tokies, of course, mockingbirds, some cardinals. Let's see, a downing woodpecker and I think it's a white-breasted nuthatch.
For somebody who just apparently got into the hobby, you seem to be very sure about your birds. And
we have a field guide book that it's really cool because it's just the birds in Georgia, and then it's arranged by color or the dominant color. So then if you see a brown and red bird, you generally would go to the brown section and just look for the bird on the page that looked most like the bird on the bird feeder.
Oh, wow. That sounds actually kind of like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a bird watcher. His name is Rob, and we go on walks in the park, and he knows every bird in the world.
So my best friend is also into bird watching. And so I started a group text with me and my wife and her, and then I named the group text Crazy Bird Girls. And then for the picture, I have Sandra Bullock from the Birds movie, where she's in the rowboat or whatever, and she's blindfolded. It was really funny.
I can't remember what the name of that movie actually was, because I'm thinking of the Birds.
Bird Box,
yes. Because the Birds was the one, the Hitchcock one. And I remember watching half of that and getting bored, which is disappointing because I'm normally a pretty big Hitchcock fan. Oh,
yeah, that one was a little silly. So what's been going on with you?
Well, I am recently back, and by recently, I mean as of about 2 hours ago, from a whirlwind family trip to Charleston, South Carolina, which consisted of me driving to Harrisburg to pick up my dad, which is about an hour and a half north of me, and then driving to South Carolina from Harrisburg, and then spending an entire one single day in Charleston with my dad and his brother, my uncle. Have you been there?
Yes, I've been to Charleston like once or twice.
I don't know if you've been there. They're that big ass craft market thing. It was this artisan's market or something. It went on for, I swear, half a mile. And because I'm a white lady tourist, I'm their target. And boy, are they good. I was buying everything. It was a pretty good experience for the slapdash thing that it was, because the goal was to get my dad off of watching Fox News for 20 hours a day and get him into a project. So my uncle had all these records that he inherited or he ended up with from somebody. And now my dad has a retirement project, which hopefully does not lead to xenophobia. I want him to start a second career as a trance DJ with his records, but have it be this kind of mix up of trance music and old timey records. And I feel like he could start a second career as a DJ.
It's definitely a niche market.
Unfortunately.
No, I don't think so.
Well, thanks for torpedoing another dream. Anyway, speaking of torpedoing dreams, do you want to discuss this week's episode?
Yeah, let's get into it.
So this is season 1, episode 8, Hit, Run, and Homicide, which I will note does not have an Oxford comma, and that's going to bug me until the day I die. So
agreed. I noticed that as well.
So let's get into it, starting from that.
Did you notice anything special about the beginning of this
episode? Oh, why, yes, I did. Tonight was the first episode of Tonight On.
Yes.
And I actually had to go back because I wasn't sure that I had heard it right, because I thought maybe my brain was inserting it just because I've watched so much Murder, She Wrote over the years. But no, this was the first time that we heard Tonight on Murder, She Wrote, which I hesitate to tell you how excited I was about it because it makes me seem like a loser, but I was pretty thrilled. I was pretty tickled.
I mean, we have a podcast about Murder, She Wrote, so you looking like a big loser is already happening.
Well, but it's happening to the book. I had to explain to my uncle when I was introducing him to podcasts. I was like, oh, you can listen to podcasts on anything. You can listen to podcasts on cycling or jazz. Or I'm like, I have a podcast. He said, about what? And then I had to explain it. And I think that he was even more confused after just explaining.
This week, I had dinner with my aunt and uncle, and my cousin was there. This is the same cousin that at his first time drinking in college, he mixed gin and Diet Coke. So I was telling him about my podcast and that he made an appearance. And then my uncle started asking me about the podcast. And my uncle is a federal judge. And he's like, well, and then he just started mansplaining like how we should do the podcast. He's like, well, you really should do a podcast on My Cousin Vinny, because that's his favorite movie of all time.
He could do a podcast on My Cousin Vinny, because we are only in season one. But how did they take it besides the mansplaining?
My cousin was very confused as to how this even came up, like how his appearance came up. And I still tried to explain to him. He's studying for the bar exam right now. So I think that his mental capacity is just not all there. But they were a little surprised at my choice, or our choice of Murder, She Wrote. Listen to the podcast, Uncle Billy, Aunt Kelly, you know, just try it out.
I have this group chat of friends, and I think they account for maybe like a not insignificant portion of our audience. And one of the chat people is my friend, who's also a lawyer, was explaining to me about how she was listening to to episode 6, and she had to drag her husband into the room and make him listen to the video will part of it. She says, and I will quote, "And then you guys got to video wills, and that's totally Alex's jam. He says 80s shows always had video wills, and that's why he'd always wanted to fuck over his heirs with a video will." So I should add that he has 3 sons.
After the Tonight on Murder, She Wrote, the credit sequence starts, and it's a beautiful scene of the ocean side. We see Jessica, she's riding her bike, and then she's continuing to ride her bike, and we see her enter, I guess, the city limits of Cabot Cove, because there's a sign that says Cabot Cove, population 3,560.
They have to change that sign every time somebody gets murdered.
Yes. And she's riding her bike, and I guess it's like the town square or downtown Cabot Cove. And she sees this other gentleman riding her bike, and this other gentleman is not paying attention to where he's going. His head is down. He's looking at this thing that's in his basket, and they almost run into each other. And she says, or maybe I think Daniel, his name's Daniel, says, "Oh, Jessica, you almost ran into me." And Jessica says, "I think you have that a little backwards, Daniel." And Daniel explains that he's paying attention to this device that's in his basket. And I deemed it to be like the first Apple Watch. So it's this device that monitors your blood pressure, your heart rate, and then your miles per hour.
I had it in my notes as a proto treadmill display. You know how whenever you're on a treadmill or an elliptical at the gym, and it monitors all that stuff in the lead up to the almost crash? It was almost slow motion, where they kept shifting the camera back and forth between the two of them. Like the collision was inevitable, and it was played for drama. And okay, Jessica, couldn't you just get out of the way? I nicknamed this guy Daniel. I nicknamed him Doc Brown, like from Back to the Future.
Oh, okay.
Because he's a wacky inventor.
Daniel, Doc Brown, he reminded me of two people. Well, but they're both cartoons. One of them was Inspector Gadget, and the other one was Belle's dad in Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, I thought of that one too. You can call him Belle's dad. I'm going to call him Doc Brown.
So they talk, and then she invites him to the Founders Day picnic lunch. He says he can't attend because he has a house guest, but Jessica says, oh no, that's even better. You've got to bring her along.
He said something to the effect of, didn't we just have one? And she said, oh, that was last year. So this guy apparently has no concept of time. I think he just doesn't want to go and he's trying to think of reasons not to go, but she cajoles him into it.
And I'm not sure how good of an inventor. I mean, he seems, and as we will see through the episode, he's apparently a very good inventor, but maybe it just takes him a few tries to get things right, because when they were standing still talking to each other, his monitoring device said he was going 22 miles an hour. So just a little kink in his invention at this point.
This is just a slight spoiler for later in the episode. He basically invented a self-driving car that worked back in 1984. And then we're supposed to see him as this kind of guy who's not quite there. The next scene is the Founders Day picnic, and it's peak America kitsch. Picnic tables with red and white checked tablecloths. There's children running around screaming unsupervised. The women, of course, are doing all the food work. And in the meantime, they're playing baseball. I guess it's mostly the little boys, and Ethan's pitching. They're having a good old time. They're fulfilling their gender roles and chirping and being good Americans. And all of a sudden, this random guy in a suit who nobody appears to know comes charging out of the woods, pursued by an errant station wagon, which crashes through the chain link fence and starts pursuing this guy who's running across the baseball field towards the children. And I don't know if it mows any of them down. I think they all get out of the way, but he got all the way to the other side of the fence. And for some reason, the car just crashes into the fence and stops, mm-hmm. and then drives away after this businessman in the suit falls on it and injures himself somehow. So that was a little weird for a lot of reasons. And it gets a little bit weirder because Ethan and Amos are having a conversation where Ethan is insisting to Amos that there was no one behind the wheel of the car. And Amos responds to that by telling Ethan he was drunk. Ethan says, but other people saw it too. And so the solution is now that everyone was hysterical. One thing that I also thought was a little, I don't know, weird, but so are you familiar with Stephen King's stuff? You know about Christine, right? I noticed that Christine came out in 1984 when this episode came out, or around the time. Do you think that they were cribbing some of Stephen King's material for this particular episode?
I would say probably not, just because really the only similarity is a car. Like, one is we find out it's driven by a remote control, so it doesn't have any autonomy. But then the Stephen King Christine car, I mean,
no, it's possessed by evil spirits. But the only reason why I was drawing the similarity is because some of the shots in this episode and the way they choose to frame things is they make it seem like the car is possessed before we learn about the remote control. It's just a spooky car.
They film some angles. It does seem like maybe the car is smirking or something after it's mowed this one guy down.
Eventually we learn that's not the case at all, but it got that impression that like the car was a character, mm-hmm. and it was a little creepy. And yeah. I started calling the car Christine for the sake of brevity.
I do want to take a second to describe this car. So it's a Chevrolet. It's brown and beige, two-tone station wagon.
So this is like the station wagon, I guess, that you would take your family on vacation in. in the 80s. Yeah. Amos goes to visit Soup Guy in the hospital, and they find out that this Soup Guy is named Mr. Woodley. He is from Boston, and he came to visit Daniel / Doc Brown. He doesn't say why. Amos tries to get a little more information out of him. Apparently, Daniel, Doc Brown, used to work for Suit Guy and his partner. And Suit Guy is throwing off some real big city energy. He doesn't want to be there. He doesn't have time for this shit. He's in traction and he's complaining about the nurses torturing him. And Woodley admits to Amos that he actually didn't see a driver in the car, which is important because it backs up what Ethan said and what basically the whole town said.
We see Jessica going to Doc Brown's house. She has a pie with her that she's going to drop off, and she meets Doc Brown's house guest. Her name is Katie Simmons, and she used to work with Daniel. They go to Daniel's workshop, and while they're on their way, which in this workshop is just kind of like a shed in his backyard, we run into Tony and Tony's fiance. Her name is Leslie Adler, but I call her Meg Ryan because she looks just like Meg Ryan. Like Meg Ryan and When Harry Met Sally, sans the super curly hair. She just has a very cute girl next door look and pretty soft spoken. But we find out she's a traveling saleswoman, and she's been traveling back and forth to Portland, which apparently is 100 miles round trip. I have that written down, so I guess that's true.
Jess is saying they're holding a pie, which is clearly a Trojan horse because she wants to snoop around. Daniel is inside his workshop, and the only thing that I can describe his workshop as is the inside of one of the TARDISes from the Doctor Who, but not the modern Doctor Who, like the Doctor Who that was in the 70s and 80s. Because have you seen much Doctor Who or any Doctor Who?
I have not seen any Doctor Who, but I have seen Get Smart from the 50s.
Yeah, that thing where there's random blinking bulbs on the wall and buttons that are supposedly supposed to do things and supposed to look all high tech, but it's just this ridiculous 80s science fiction thing. And oh my gosh, I thought it was the funniest thing. And it says, my notes say Daniel is fixing his bike inside the TARDIS.
I imagine the set director told everyone, he's like, okay, make it look inventor, because there's just blinking lights. There's stuff spinning. You don't know what anything does. There's blueprints on the wall. And I don't know if you notice this, but this is the cleanest workshop I have ever seen.
Doc Brown's actual workshop for Back to the Future was just a hoarder's nightmare. Bell's father, these are the only inventors we know, by the way, his place was a mess. There was stuff everywhere. He's working on his bike and he thinks he's got it figured out. And as they're talking, and he and Jess, we find out that Tony had only met Meg Ryan about a month ago. So this has been a whirlwind courtship and engagement. So I don't know how common that was back then, but it seems to happen a lot in Murder, She Wrote, where people know each other for a very short period of time and then they get married. So I don't know if this is supposed to arouse suspicion or if we're supposed to just kind of see this as all those crazy kids to be young again.
Well, and it sounded like that Doc Brown was encouraging Tony to, I think in his words, nail her down fast, put a ring on it.
My guess is because, does Tony have a job that we know of?
So he works at the bank.
The bank. Doing what?
Bank stuff.
Oh. Well, she seems to be like a woman of the 80s. She's probably on her way up and really fast. So he'll be able to retire and be a stay-at-home husband at the rate she's going. He probably is looking at Tony, who, despite being chiseled, kind of seems a little, I don't know what the word is.
He might be a little naive.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. And he seems to take everything at face value, and he seems very trusting of what other people say, which is apparently the worst quality that you can possess in situations this, because people will take advantage of that forever. Jess also tells Doc Brown about Woodley, the guy, suit guy in the hospital. And we find out that not only did Daniel not invite Woodley up here, as suit guy had told Amos, but Daniel hates him with a passion. He's ready to set him on fire if he comes within 100 yards of him, which is an interesting development, because that suddenly we don't know why suit guy is here, and Daniel's not happy and he won't go see him. He doesn't want to know why he's here.
And in the next scene, it looks like that we're at the docks in Cabot Cove. And so
that's the real downtown.
The real downtown Cabot Cove is the docks. And another guy in a suit gets off a boat, and he asks Ethan where all the taxis are. And then Ethan explains that the taxis are at the train station, because most out of towners come to Cabot Cove in the train. And apparently the train station is a couple miles away. Ethan asks, well, where are you going? The new out of towner suit guy says, to the hospital. So at this point, I think that we are supposed to put it together that this is Woodley's business partner, Dean Merrill. And he says, oh, well, the hospital's only a mile away. It's that way. So then the guy, the out-of-towner suit guy, starts walking. We see him walking in a road. It's kind of, there's a hill on one side and then a drop off on the other. And he's got a newspaper and then a briefcase in one hand. And then we see the station wagon creeping up behind him. And then the station wagon goes a little faster and faster. And finally, the guy starts running. And as he's running, he drops the newspaper, presumably so he can run faster. But he holds on to the briefcase. And he never lets go of the briefcase.
Well, and he also doesn't get out of the way. That's another thing. If somebody's chasing you, or something is chasing you, and there's a fairly good chance that if you were to jump out of the way, they wouldn't be able to course correct to pursue you. That's what I would have done. If I were being chased by an errant automobile, I would jump out of the way.
Yes, he could have jumped down the hill, and the station wagon would not have been able to pursue him, or maybe even just turned a sharp U-turn.
Or just stepped off the road. It seems like a really inefficient way to kill somebody with, well, first of all, it's not a sports car that can take turns really quickly or whatever. It's this big old lumpy ass family of five station wagon, which I really didn't understand why they chose that particular model, but nobody asked me when they were writing this. Sorry, I'm drinking a Red Bull and I'm trying not to burp onto the recording. Just give me a second.
Sure.
Okay, I think I'm good. I should also point out that the guy, the business partner, Merrill, like, I called him fake Boston accent, because whatever accent that he has when he's talking to Ethan just seems like a little put on, like a little too much. You know what I mean?
It didn't sound Boston-y at all. It sounded fake Southern-y to me.
It did? Oh. Yeah. Because I thought they were going for like a New England, like kind of JFK type of accent. I don't even know. Yeah. Well, I mean, the fact that we're disagreeing on what kind of accent is means that he probably failed.
Yeah.
I should also point out that the exchange between him and Ethan was actually pretty funny.
It was really funny.
Because basically what happens is Ethan's just chilling. Like, he doesn't have anywhere to be. He's not in any hurry. And this guy is urgently trying to get to the hospital or to a taxi. And every time he asks Ethan the question, he just gets increasingly more frustrated with the answer. And it's one of the funniest scenes in this episode. It's just Ethan just calmly answering a question, like whatever. And he's like, but what about this? He's like, oh, well, the hospital's just a mile down the road. And oh my God, it was just, it's something that I can't really replicate by recounting it. But the scene itself was just very well acted.
And And Ethan at one point says, oh, but you could always ask old Pete for a ride. He'll give you a ride anywhere for five. Oh, great. Where can I find old Pete? He's down at the trade station.
Pretty great.
Not helpful at all.
Okay. So after the, well, I guess at this point, at the end of the scene, the car was following him. Do we know that he eats it in this scene or are we uncertain? Okay.
The next scene, we find out that he's deceased.
Jessica in the next scene is typing in her kitchen and Ethan rushes in, presumably without knocking, and announces that Dean Merrill is dead. He was hit by a big spooky station wagon and that some kids saw the murder and that Ethan thinks that Amos can't handle the investigation because I don't think he thinks very highly of Amos just in general. It basically tells Jessica she needs to go and force herself upon Amos to help solve this investigation. And he makes the reference to Amos clearing his throat because every time, I guess that's his tell or something. So every time he doesn't know what he's doing or he's nervous or he's uncertain, he's just clearing his throat.
It's funny because the next scene we're back in like the town square of Cabot Cove and it's Sheriff Tepper and he's got a cup of coffee and he's continuously clearing his throat. And then Jessica rides up to him and asks, are there any leads on who killed Merrill? And he says, not yet. And she kind of in a very Jessica Fletcher way, politely plants the seed and suggests to Sheriff Tepper how he needs to investigate the case. And that's why one reason I love Jessica Fletcher so much is because she knows how to play people. And then he frames it as in, you could tag along. It might be helpful. It might be good research for your next book.
Oh, that was so nice of him to help her with her book. The next scene that we get is in the hospital and Amos is back there interrogating Woodley with Jessica at his side. And what Woodley is doing is he is pointing the finger at Doc Brown and essentially saying that Doc Brown invited him up to Cabot Cove so that he could run him down in public and murder him. And I'm not sure if it's at this point that we find out that this self-driving car or whatever has been kind of Daniel's pet project over the years, but Suit Guy seems bound and determined to throw the blame on Daniel. And then he finds out that Daniel wasn't the one who called and invited him. He just can't believe it. It blows his mind.
We do find out in this scene that Doc Brown, while he was working for Woodley, did come up with the technology for the remote control car.
And we get some of that in the next scene where they start talking about that. Doc Brown is talking to Jessica and is explaining to her the saga of the driverless car, which he managed to invent and perfect 25 years before Elon Musk or Uber or anybody ever decided to try. And apparently the car was safe and it worked, but it was too expensive to produce. And so that's part of the reason why he got the boot, was that he was burning up money on these ridiculous projects that would never be profitable. To which I say, like, modern life has clearly demonstrated that a driverless car, if one were to be able to perfect it, it would change everything. Oh, yeah. And people are pouring billions of dollars into research and development on this thing. And there's this rinky-dink inventing company saying, oh, this costs too much money. It's like, oh, we understand you already got it perfect and it's fine, but we don't want to pay for it, even though, like, I can imagine they would make ungodly amounts of money.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, I guess my only argument to that would be maybe there wasn't really the demand or people didn't realize the utility of it, but I don't know. I kind of doubt that.
Yeah, because I mean, as long as there have been chauffeurs and taxis and drivers, I feel like people like the driverless car has been like it was on the friggin' Jetsons, like that kind of stuff. I feel like that was like well in the public zeitgeist or consciousness or whatever that it would have been at least viable as something to sell to a bigger company to develop. But Tony, in the meantime, is just asking a lot of questions with no particular reason why he's asking these questions. And Doc Brown still hates Suit Guy, despite the fact that he's still injured.
And then the next scene is a really short scene, and we see Jessica. She's on the phone, and she's on the phone with Letitia. We've not seen Letitia, but we've heard Letitia before a few episodes ago. I can't remember which one.
It was, I think it was the one with Ralph, your best friend,
Oh,
because she's the one
yeah,
who
you're
tells the
right.
operator. She's the one who snitches.
Yeah. And she says something to the effect of, "I know it's confidential, but please just give me the phone numbers."
And then she gets the phone numbers immediately.
Which, so I don't know if you read this court case in criminal procedure, but this was a pretty old court case. But basically, the ruling of the court case was that the numbers that you dial from your personal phone are not confidential. Essentially, the police do not need a search warrant to get those numbers.
She could also be referring to the idea that maybe it was like company policy not to
Yes.
give them out to civilians, or if Amos had asked for it, she'd give it to him. But I guess maybe she has to cajole her a little bit because she's just Joe Schmo asking, "Do you think if I called an operator and like asked to see my neighbor's records? I think my teenage daughter has been sneaking out to see the boy next door. I'd really like to see their phone records." I think this comes up later in the series. Like being Letitia, she's got to have an exalted position in that town because I guarantee you she fucking knows everything.
Oh, she knows everything about everybody.
And the dirt that she must have, I stand in awe of her, just even though I don't think we ever meet her
Yeah,
in
I
real
would love
life.
to see a show just about Letitia.
Yeah, it's just people like her listening in on conversations in Cabot Cove,
That would have been
like
a good spinoff.
the murder capital of the world. Jessica goes over to Daniel's house again to confront him because there were two calls from Daniel's number that were made to numbers in Boston. And she wants to know, "Well, you said you didn't make this call, but look at this. I've got the hard evidence that I got from the operator, who is a snitch, by the way. Don't trust her." And she's talking to Katie on the porch because I guess Daniel is, he's back destroying the garden. So he's not on the porch. There's two numbers. One of them, I can't remember what it was for.
It was
So
Tony's number at the bank.
yeah, it was Tony's number at the bank. And then the second one was Suit Guy, Mr. Woodley's office in Boston. So apparently that's the smoking gun. And Jess wants to know, "Well, you said you didn't make the call, but here it is in black and white. Who made the calls?" And while we're having this conversation about the phone numbers and with Katie, it comes to light that Daniel apparently was fired because he was too forward-thinking, and I guess he was wasting money with all these space-age inventions of his. To which I say, isn't that the fucking point?
Right,
It,
true.
if you're an inventor and you're brought on to invent new products and you invent things that are viable, well, theoretically are viable and could have an appeal to a large enough market.
And then not only did they fire him for essentially doing his job, they tried to keep his designs and his inventions after he was fired, which is a little confusing because if they thought that his designs and inventions were garbage and that's why they're firing him, why did they want to keep them? And that created some big, long litigation in which Doc Brown eventually won. So he got to keep all of his patents and designs, but it cost him nearly his entire savings.
While Jessica and Katie are having this conversation on the front porch, Doc Brown is in the backyard and he's invented some kind of device that emits a frequency or a sound or something to keep pests aphids away. Yeah. So it's a sound that only aphids can hear and they don't want to be near the scary sound. So and first of all, like, that is an ugly ass piece of machinery to just plant down in the middle of flowers and be like, okay, I fixed it.
It looks like a tiki torch.
Yeah. I'm like, you ruined the whole motif by putting down this ugly ass clonky thing. And then he turns it on and every dog in the neighborhood loses his fucking mind because he's basically made a dog whistle.
It was so funny that.
If this is the quality of work that he was producing while he was working with those guys in Boston, like, I don't fucking blame them for firing him.
I mean, he's just got to figure out the kinks, just like with his monitoring device.
Yes, but you'd think that somebody who supposedly has his experience and pedigree wouldn't be getting hung up on things that seem to be like pretty obvious, because it almost seems like a wacky, like every time one of his inventions fail, it's like in some kind of wacky way. Like, oh, look at that. You pissed off every dog in the neighborhood. Oh, look at that. Like, you're going 22 miles an hour while you're standing still. Like, it's just, it's almost like it's meant for comic relief.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So one important thing that I do want to note that came out of that last scene was it became very apparent that Katie is in love with Doc Brown. She was very much defending him and going on about how kind and gentle and smart he was and how he could never hurt anyone. And basically she's in love with him.
It's the geriatric romance.
You did say that.
Okay, good. Just tying it all together.
Yeah. So the next scene, we're at Jessica's house and she's cleaning the table off from dinner. At dinner was Ethan and Tony and Meg Ryan. And Meg Ryan mentions that she had a big lunch in Portland, so that's why she didn't eat a lot of dinner. And Ethan was starving because he was looking for that station wagon all day long, I guess like on foot, literally just searching the town for the station wagon.
Okay, you can see that station wagon from space. So I feel like if they just got like one helicopter involved, like from like the state police or something, they could find it in like 5 minutes.
After the like search party had concluded for the day, the sheriff was like, oh guys, I think I figured out what happened. So there were some helicopters that were looking on the highway, what was it, yesterday or maybe the day before, and then the helicopter saw this really big moving van going north on the highway. So what happened clearly was that the station wagon was in that moving van.
Jess thinks that the car is hiding, and I think she thinks it's hiding not like a quarry, but this kind of area of the woods that I wouldn't even know how to describe it. It's like an area, it's a wooded area, but it also has a lot of rocks in it. She thinks that's where it is, like in this very specific part of the woods. So what she does is she goes to Amos, who is Krabby Pants, and he refuses to spend any more money or manpower looking for the car on this old, it's an old farm actually, apparently. He still thinks it's in the moving van despite having no evidence to that effect. And she starts bugging him about it. And he basically tells her she can go investigate on her own with his blessing if she'll just leave him the hell alone. So she gets permission to snoop and she's off to the races.
So two things that I noticed from this scene, one of them was an ashtray.
Oh, good show.
Yes. And then the second on Sheriff Amos Tupper's bookshelf, there were a bunch of Southeastern reporters. Like, he shouldn't even be allowed to buy them.
So for those of you out there who did not spend $1 million going to law school, a Southeastern reporter is certain decisions, mostly made by appeals courts, get the opinions get published in these reporters, which when you see a lawyer on TV and he has a bunch of books in back of him, that's what those are. That's essentially a librarification
of case law.
Of case law, yeah. So in the days before what we have now is like we have Westlaw, we have Lexis, they have a number of software and computer platforms that have taken the place of those books. So we don't have to look through 30 books to find something. But some lawyers still like the books. But A, those things are as expensive as hell. Mm-hmm. And B, like the sheriff shouldn't have them. Because it's not his job. Like, he doesn't need them. Like, he's right. Not going to be brushing up on case law in between wrongfully accusing people and taking naps.
Did they still publish Southeastern reporters?
I think they do. But I think it's one of those things where I think you have to special order them. They're very expensive and they're completely unnecessary because Westlaw and Lexis for the win.
All right. Okay. So after Jessica receives Sheriff Tupper's blessing to go look at the old gentry farm for this vehicle, she goes on about her way. She's biking in this really thick, densely forested, wooded area. And she's biking along. And then, like, this one was really weird. And I didn't really understand why this part was even in it, but like there's a person who has a mirror and is like shining the mirror in her face. At one point she gets off the bike and I think it's because she like can't, there's like the path ends maybe, and then she goes through this little bitty wooded area, but of course she finds the station. And what do you think she does? A fucking station wagon.
First, what she does is she kind of feels the hood of the car, I guess, to find out if it's been driven recently. Mm-hmm. And from her reaction, it appears that it's still warm and that it's been used recently. So this piques her interest. She gets in the car and then we see, like, I mean, theoretically, wouldn't she be able to see there's like a conversion van that's like 12 feet away?
You couldn't see the van from the car, I don't think. Like from the camera angle, I don't think that you could see the van parked behind the station wagon. But like you did see like this station, it was a Ford van. It was red and gray. And it pulls up somewhat behind her, but I think that it remains hidden. But okay. Then inside the van, you see someone with like a black glove and they start like flipping switches. So like a switch for on, ignition, lock doors, lock windows, and then shift. And then the car takes off with Jessica in it. She gets locked in the car and then the car is like going full speed ahead.
So this apparently complicated set of controls again reminds me of early Doctor Who, whenever they're flipping controls in the TARDIS to get somewhere to the next planet or whatever. And apparently she's in this car, she's riding Christine straight to hell. And the next scene or couple of scenes is just this fucking insane, like it's supposed to be like a car chase, but she's in the car, they're not chasing anybody, she's just driving. And they're outside of town and they're in a high speed chase, but they're chasing nobody, the conversion van is following. And first of all, she looks more annoyed than she
does. Yes, she never even looked frightened, she looked inconvenienced.
But one funny part was whenever she was speeding down the road behind the wheel of this car that was driving itself, there were these two guys walking along the side of the road with fishing gear. And one of them turns to the other and says, "Wasn't that Jessica Fletcher driving?" And then they just kind of shrug and keep walking.
Well, what I thought was funny is that they were clearly Canadian. Like, they both had the Canadian voice. Like, "Hey, wasn't that Jessica?" Well, that's not a good Canadian. That just came out in New York. But then the other guy said, "Hey."
She's headed into town, and Ethan in his truck kind of sees what's going on, and I guess he's starting to follow her, intercept her. The question that I had was, she can't stop the car, but can she at least steer?
No, because at one point she's trying to steer. She's like grabbing the steering wheel and it's not doing anything. The car is continuing to move however it wants to.
She busts through a gate into a lighthouse. Is she going to go into the lighthouse or the sea? Because either one of them would be bad. But I feel like the sea would be probably worse, especially since she can't get out of the car. She gets to the edge of a cliff, and all of a sudden you see the black gloved hand switch off. And then the van, you can see the van at this point. And then the van is just kind of there and it just drives away.
And then she has the funny line where, like, finally the door is unlocked and Ethan opens the door and, "Oh my God, Jessica, are you okay?" And she just said, "And you wonder why I don't drive a car."
Everything's fine. The car is there. And I guess they're now in possession of the car. And Amos is looking through it. He finds out that there are some prints or some plans or some prototypes or some pieces of paper in the back seat that have Doc Brown's name on it. And apparently that's enough to implicate him. Why would you incriminate yourself by putting something that only you could have at a crime scene?
Well, he is a little absent-minded, I would say.
I mean, there's absent-minded and then there's just like
stupid. Yeah.
Stupid. Yeah. And I think he hasn't crossed that Rubicon.
No, it wasn't a Jeep Rubicon. It was a station wagon.
Oh, damn. Rim shot. We are back to the inventor lab, which I designated again as a 1980s Doctor Who villain lab, because I thought that was a little bit more succinct than from before. And they figure out through looking at papers that the device that Doc Brown designed was the same one that was in Christine, the station wagon. This apparently is conclusive evidence that because Doc Brown invented this device and put it in this car and is now murdering people, mm-hmm. obviously he's guilty.
So the next scene, it's apparently later that night, and I guess it's taking place at a hotel, but it's Meg Ryan and she's brushing her hair. And she's talking to Tony and tells Tony that she loves his uncle, but he's really been acting weird lately. Maybe he should get some kind of psychiatric evaluation. And then Tony's talking and then takes his shirt off and yowza.
I guess Tony is the heir apparent to the Doc Brown fortune. Mm-hmm. So it looks like there's some angle on that. That maybe she's getting it. She's a really weird character because we don't see much of her.
Oh, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. She reminds me of Amelia. Like, we just periodically get reminded that she exists mm-hmm. through like these scenes where just some weird shit is going on.
Yeah. And I think that's by design too. The next scene, it's Jessica and Katie and they're on a walk. And it looks like they might be in the woods again, the old gentry farm, but that wouldn't make sense. So they're just on a walk.
I thought they were investigating. That's what I have in my notes. Oh. They went back to the woods to snoop around.
Maybe they are. And then Jessica is asking a bunch of questions like, "I can't believe that Doc Brown was fired. He's so brilliant and intelligent and blah, blah, blah." And then Katie just says again, "Well, like I said, they thought he was wasting money, but really, I think they just fired him because Woodley is trying to save his own salary."
And they also said that the partners were in financial difficulty at the time and they were kind of at each other's throats a little bit. So there was all that businessman stuff going on while mm-hmm. the poor inventor just kind of hung out and got the short end of the stick.
And it was a 50-50 partnership between Merrill and Woodley. Merrill provided the money. Woodley ran the show. Now that Merrill's dead, Woodley, I guess, inherited Merrill's 50%, which generally that's not the way things go. Usually you bequeath your ownership to your family, but I guess, you know, that's not always the case.
Depending on what their partnership agreement looked like, they should be severable interests and they would be like part of the estate and passed on to the heirs and assigns or whatever. But no, apparently there was like a right of survivorship or something. Doc Brown is in a jail cell and they're all hanging out in jail and they're trivializing mental illness. And I think they're kind of gaslighting him a little bit. And this is where I'm getting a little bit confused because he hasn't been arrested for anything. Well, he's been arrested, but he hasn't been like, are they like laying the groundwork for an insanity defense? I'm just like really confused about procedurally, like what's going on at this point in the episode.
Okay, so he has been arrested and he's waiting on his bail hearing or his bond hearing. Jessica is in the jail cell with him. So I don't know what kind of show Sheriff Tupper's running back there, but okay. And you're right. Doc Brown is saying, well, maybe I really did do this and I just don't remember. Maybe I'm a schizoid. Maybe I'm Jekyll and Hyde and I don't even know it. And Jessica's just kind of brushing that under the rug or saying, I really don't think so. Let's not worry about this. She even says, like, in Sheriff Tupper's own house, they don't have a case against you. Doc Brown does mention that Tony's hired a lawyer for him and the lawyer wants him to have a psychiatric evaluation.
So what is the basis for them thinking he's crazy, despite the fact that he's insisting that he's innocent and that he's an inventor?
I think it's just one defense that they're setting up. They could, you know, have multiple defenses, but this is just one at their disposal.
Well, it just seems like it is one at their disposal, but they seem to be pushing it pretty hard. I know Meg Ryan was before, and it almost like reminds me, if we're talking about crazy inventors in Beauty and the Beast, where they throw Maurice in the asylum, they're gaslighting him and then they're kind of trivializing mental illness, using the term schizoid, kind of throwing around a lot of terms that some of them aren't actual diagnoses. It's very frustrating to see that kind of thing treated so casually and like a prop or a storyline.
But you've got to remember, like, the destigmatization of mental illness and mental health has really just been in the last 2 or 3 years.
The next scene, we see Jess is pushing her bike along the side of the road, and Tony, who's driving his fancy convertible, pulls up alongside her.
He stops in the middle of the road, in like the middle of a curve. And again, there is like an embankment on one side and then a drop off on the other. He could not have picked a more dangerous spot to just park. Not only park, he turns his car off.
He puts the bike in the car and they're chit-chatting. And Jess starts asking about Doc Brown and this preemptive exam to find out if he's crazy, so to speak. She insists that he's not crazy. Tony says it's just in case, and that's the extent of the conversation. Tony has to get some gas, so he says the gas gauge is messed up, and he has to be safe because Meg Ryan's been going back and forth to Portland so much that she's been using all of his gas, so he has to get more. And he pulls over into a service station, and while he's getting gas, she starts snooping through the glove compartment, which is totally reasonable, and I probably would do it too. And she finds the car rental agreement with Meg Ryan's name on it, notices the gas mileage, and then kind of takes a look, I guess, at the odometer, and something's not right. He only owes $7 for gas, which I couldn't tell if that was a lot or not a lot, because I don't know how much 80s money.
So at first I thought that would have been a lot.
I thought so too.
Then I did some Googling, some sleuthing, if you will. And the average gallon of gas back in 84 was about 90 cents per gallon. So he took about 8 gallons of gas. And then I did a station wagon. I Googled the wrong car.
Yeah, but you can't imagine that thing's very fuel efficient.
Yeah. So let's say 18 miles per gallon. So that would have been 144 miles.
Which is not enough to go to Portland all those times.
Right. But we don't know if Meg Ryan has ever put more gas in the vehicle herself.
But then there's also the odometer. Yeah. But Jess apparently has her, maybe not her aha moment, but her what's going on here. Yeah. And so we're back in the Doctor Who villain lab. And Tony pulls up, lets Jess out. Doc Brown comes out with the Katie, and they put him in the car, and I guess they're taking him to wherever he's going to be evaluated for mental illness or mm-hmm. what have you. They make it sound like he's going away, like, to be committed.
He even says, it's not like I'm being committed. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah.
I'm wrong.
It was very dramatic because, like, there was the scene where he's turning off all of his inventions in his lab and then turning the lights off. So yeah, it was very melodramatic.
The next scene is Jessica gossiping with the grocery store clerk. She's complaining because for some reason the grocery store has this one kind of kitschy arcade game. And this grocery clerk seems to believe that this single arcade game is like responsible for the moral devolution of the youth in the town. Like, she really fucking hates that thing.
Really? I just thought she didn't like the loud noise.
Oh, I thought she was taking a moral stance. No,
that's not what I got. But
okay, maybe I was not listening to her. And we go over there and you expect to see like a kid, but it's Ethan, mm-hmm. who is 12 apparently. Mm-hmm. And this is like the world's easiest game. It's like drive this group of pixels that's supposed to be a car and have it avoid. It's like, I would imagine like, it's like Pong's version of Mario Kart, mm-hmm. or something like that. And I'm like, is this like the prototype for Grand Theft Auto or something? Like, is this its first iteration?
What's the video game where you're like an airplane and then you've got like the missiles and stuff and you're shooting the missiles at the other planes that are trying to bomb you or wreck you?
I know what you're talking about, but I can't remember.
Okay. Well, that it looks very similar to that.
Ethan is playing this game and it's kind of a very simplistic game. It's an 80s video game, but he seems to be like super into it and acting like this is like the most insane test of skill that ever there was.
Oh, so, and he says not hand-eye coordination. He says it takes hand-to-eye coordination, which I guess maybe the saying as well, but I just thought that was funny.
Just kind of takes over. He challenges her or says that there's no way you could do it, because this is really hard and I'm so good at it. And so she starts kicking Ethan's ass, like in the game, and he's backseat driving and he's trying to tell her what to do, but she's miles ahead of him, so to speak. And then she has an aha moment at one point, which is our favorite Jessica Fletcher aha moment. And I guess this is kind of where she realizes that the driverless car was operated from the conversion van, which is why the conversion van was kind of nearby while that shit was going down. And I guess that's her epiphany that leads us to the next scene.
We're back like at the little park where we had the Founders Day picnic. There's sheriff and police everywhere. You can hear like the sheriff radio going on. And Tony and Meg Ryan pull up. And they get out and Tony asks what's going on. And the sheriff says he's going to like recreate or reconstruct what happened a couple days ago with the car running over Woodley in hopes that it would maybe jog some people's recollection. And apparently Woodley has agreed to help. He's now out of the hospital. He's walking on a cane. And Jessica has suggested to the sheriff that Tony needed to be there since he was Doc Brown's nephew. Somehow that makes sense. So that's
Tony and Meg Ryan are both a little suspicious of what's going on and like visibly nervous. All of a sudden, here comes Christine. She starts approaching, following, I guess, more or less the same trajectory. But at some point, does it look like she's about to run into them? Is that what happens?
Well, yes. But before Christine, the station wagon starts going crazy, we see the conversion van pull up. And yes, so everyone's just like talking around. And then the station wagon pulls up and it starts beelining for Woodley again. And Woodley and Sheriff, they're talking together. They both start running. I think that the sheriff was smart enough to kind of move out of the way and not continue to run in a straight line like Woodley does. But he throws his cane and starts running full speed. And he runs to the fence because it's like a baseball field. So he runs to like the fence behind home plate and starts climbing it up. And while this is happening, Woodley yells to Meg Ryan. Her real name was Leslie. He says, "Leslie, turn it off," something like that. And Leslie runs to the conversion van and opens the door. And at about that time, Jessica screams for Ethan. "Okay, that's enough." And we see that Ethan has been controlling the station wagon from his truck.
Once they realize that Meg Ryan has run over to the conversion van and opened the door, Jessica starts asking her these kind of innocent looking questions. And then Meg Ryan tries to cover for herself. And then they point at Ethan and that's enough for her to just throw up her hands and start snitching. And then Jessica confronts her with the fact that she didn't have enough mileage on the car to have gone back and forth to Portland all those times. And it's at that point that the whole house of cards falls. It was Woodley and her. They were working together to knock off Dean Merrill so that he could get all the money. And that it just so happened that, maybe not just so happened, and they were going to frame Doc Brown because he cray cray. And now it's all gone up in flames.
So like the next scene is everyone at dinner. And Jessica's kind of explaining what's going on or what happened. And it sounds like Woodley maybe hired Meg Ryan to fall in love or to get Tony to fall in love with her, because it was stated that, okay, so Merrill's dead. So that means Woodley owns 100% of the partnership and they need to get Doc Brown's invention. So with Doc Brown either being deemed, you know, incompetent or guilty for killing Merrill, Tony would be in charge of Doc Brown's estate. And they couldn't kill Doc Brown because if they killed Doc Brown, his inventions would be donated to his alma mater, the University of Maine. So now with Doc Brown out of the way, Tony would control the estate and then Meg Ryan would control Tony. At that point, I'm thinking, and this is where there's a legality issue, is that Tony could then, I don't know, sell the invention or give the invention to Woodley. But
if he were like a guardian or something, like, wouldn't he have powers to do that? Like, if they could deem that it was like in the best interest of the estate.
Yes, he would still have a fiduciary duty, but that duty would still be to Doc Brown or his estate. So
yeah,
it's not like
he could theoretically argue like, yes, I sold this to so-and-so, sold in quotation marks, but mm-hmm. that was just to earn some money to help him pay his crazy house bill.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Tony couldn't just go giving the patents and inventions away, but I guess if Woodley didn't tell them how, I guess, important the designs were, or how much money that Woodley stand to gain off the designs, then yeah, he could probably lowball Tony.
Yeah, they'd be like, "I'll pay you $50,000 for this," and then Tony could be like, "Oh, well, we need that to pay for your medical bill," and then all of a sudden, someone's making $1 billion over here. And we kind of end on a bit of a sweet slash funny note where Doc Brown finally gets with the program and realizes that, like, Katie's all about him. I guess she's supposed to go back to wherever she came from.
He says, I can't go back to Tennessee with you, but I'll move heaven and earth to get you to stay here with me. And then Ethan and Jessica go off to the grocery store to play in an arcade tournament.
Well, that's after they eavesdrop. And the funny part about the ending is that Ethan's like, oh, I'm going to go do an arcade tournament. And Jess says she'll go along. And he seems like alarmed by that. Like, suddenly, like, he's threatened. And then they're joking about it on the way out of the door. I think it's safe to say that she kicked his ass. So that is the end of the episode. Did you like this episode, Laura?
I did like this episode. It was cute. It was simple. I liked it. It was fun. I give it 7.5 asterisks.
There were parts that I liked, and perhaps it's kind of my fault for maybe not paying as much attention as I should have, because in an act of hubris, I try to take notes like while it's playing. So sometimes I miss stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't give it 7.5. I might give it 6.5. There were definitely some fun moments. It was a little bit lighter this time on, like, legal stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot more wacky. It kind of depended a lot more on, like, physical humor, I guess. But it wasn't bad. It was kind of a nice change of pace from all the very dense, like, legal stuff heavy. And
a nice break from the freaking narcissist sociopath from last episode.
While you were watching, did you happen to stumble upon a Golden Grady?
So I have 3 nominees for the Golden Grady. So I want to hear your choice first, and then I will give it to someone else. Because I feel certain that at least you're going to pick one of the 3 that I have nominated.
My Golden Grady goes to Ethan.
Oh,
because okay. of this childlike wonder in playing the world's simplest video game, and also assuming that A, he's going to be better at it than her, and B, that it's like a life and death thing. It seems like the type of, like, dumb thing that Grady would get obsessed with and then just beat to death. So that's why I'm giving it to Ethan.
Okay. Well, Ethan was not one of my 3 nominees. My 3 nominees were Sheriff Tubman because, I mean, it's him failing up. Like, he quote unquote catches the guilty guy, but only because Jessica Fletcher, the woman, pretty much does all the work. And then I'm sure Sheriff Tupper gets all the credit. And then the second nominee was Tony, because, I mean, what does he really do? He's just like a pretty, like, I'm really glad you're there because you're easy on the eyes, but I don't really know what you do in life. And then, but I guess I'll have to give the award to Doc Brown, because again, quintessential white man failing up who has no idea what's going on around him. This woman, the love of his life, maybe has been in front of him for years and years and years, and he's just had his eyes down the whole time. And he even says, like, at one point, she's been saving my life for years. And it's taken you 60 years to realize this?
I mean, sometimes it does, because they're just so dense, and especially if you're an absent-minded professor type. I know I'm not very helpful by picking not any of those 3, but, like, if you had to pick one, who would it be?
It would be Doc Brown.
All right, solid agree with that. Solid agree. Okay, well, before we go, do you just want to talk briefly about next episode, meaning just read the synopsis on IMDb and then call it a day?
Jessica goes to Kansas to be with one of her nieces, and there's something about an amusement park, and then the amusement park owner dies. And also, it's the first episode where we have, like, really big guest stars. They're not really big stars at the time, but they will become really big stars.
Ooh, I will have to keep my mouth shut about that one, and we will find out next week who that famous person is. Okay, so again, like, thank you guys for bearing with us while we figure out a schedule. Hopefully we can all get back on the same, some kind of normalcy now that I vowed not to leave the state of Maryland for an entire month. So thanks to everyone for listening, to Rachel for album art, and remember, stay woke.
Stay woke.